Welcome to Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFVA. Over the next hour, you'll be introduced to business and local leaders impacting our community. Text your comments or questions directly to the studio in real time via ZipWhip landline texting at 540-371-5756 or comment on Facebook at WFVA 1230. Now, the host of Town Talk, Ted Shulman.
We're going to preview the General Assembly this morning with Caroline Delegate Bobby Orrock from the 54th District. Delegate Orrock, it's good to have you here this morning.
Well, good morning. Good to be here, Ted. Thank you.
It is. It's always good to talk about the General Assembly with you. I'm trying to think what session this is. Is this 25?
This will be my 27th session coming up. This is my 26th year completion of service.
Okay. So what numbers on your license plate? That always, because you started, didn't you start at 98?
96.
Okay.
Yeah, now I'm at number four, which for the listeners, all that is two things. One, it's a reflection of your seniority in the House. And secondly, with a dollar, you can go to some fast food joints and get a cup of coffee with that license number. Yeah. But anyway.
but I'm driving around and I see that number, I'm thinking that's a high-ranking state official.
And it does mean that I've been there long enough that I've got a little greater knowledge of the process, a little greater effectiveness, I hope. Sidebar listeners might be interested to know as well, though, that we have to pay not only the same vanity plate fee, it's not a perk, as they have to pay for their personalized plates, but we have to pay an additional administrative fee for DMV to keep track of these 100 numbers, which has always befuddled me. But anyway, so I guess call me vain because I pay that little extra money so that I can have that number four so people can look at me and make comments about my driving, I suppose. I don't know. But anyway.
Well, I didn't know that you had to pay for that. I just thought you're a member of the General Assembly and that's something the state
not
picks
a perk.
Up.
Nope, it's not. Nope, we got to pay out of our pocket.
Wow. Okay. Well, that's what I've learned today.
We can end it now. We've learned a lesson.
That's what we've learned. One of the other things that you are known for, and for people who watch the General Assembly online, I'm one of those people. I don't know how many there are, but as far as the parliamentary rules go, the speaker often calls on you, or you find little tiny things during debate, and oftentimes are able to stop debate because it's gotten off track.
Yeah, and actually, there is no official parliamentarian position, but I'm kind of the de facto ad hoc, you get what you paid for kind of parliamentarian. It started more so, frankly, when Morgan Griffith from the Salem-Roanoke area was in the House, and I picked up a few things from Morgan while he was there. Also, it is one of the things I teach my students in school is basic parliamentary procedure.
I was going to ask you about that.
Excuse me. So over the years, once Morgan left, the speaker came to me and has asked my advice over the years. And I frequently will huddle with him on matters and with the clerk staff and those folks. So, yeah, it is an important position given that rules matter.
Yeah.
Because if you don't do things by the rules, then potential actions we take in the legislature could be subject to legal challenge down the road. So we got to make sure we go by our own rules. That's what they're there for. And that protects both sides, both the majority and the minority.
It's good to know that that's still being taught in school, too, because it's good to know how, just like you say,
right,
meetings need to be run.
And I don't know how widely it's taught. I teach agriculture classes, which probably surprises people, one, that they're even being taught in our schools. But actually, they're an applied science class. But as a part of that, students are involved with the FFA, and as a leadership component of that, we teach how to run meetings and parliamentary law and things of that nature.
One of the things, you're a teacher at Spotsylvania High School, and so during this year's session, you'll be gone January to through March, middle of March. Boy, that's got to – just knowing – living with a teacher and knowing lesson plans and all that kind of thing, there's – every year for for 26 years, you've had to have a sub come in at least in January and February.
Right, and I line up my own substitute, do the lesson plans, come in weekends and make sure things are put in the system, that kind of thing. I've been fortunate for the second year now, actually a former college roommate who's a retired agriculture teacher from Hanover County. It's going to be coming in and filling in for me. So it's making it a little bit easier this last year and hopefully this one coming.
You're chairman, aren't you, of a committee or
Health,
two?
Health, Welfare, and Institutions Committee.
Okay.
And people hear that title and go, what? And it does mean we deal with the health issues. We deal with the social service issues, a la the welfare component. An institution speaks to not only our medical and mental care facilities, but also Department of Corrections institutions. When legislation may be introduced affecting that, comes through our committee as well. So it's kind of a broad brush. But predominantly, we deal with the health care issues. One that we know is going to be coming up this year is the Certificate of Public Need. That was a measure that I carried a bill on last year, trying to build some reform, and I know other legislators are going to be pushing for additional reforms this coming year. And for the listeners, the cliff notes of what that is.
I was going to ask you about that. Yeah.
You know, and in government, sometimes we get caught up in these acronyms, COPN or CON, whatever. About 50, 60 years ago, Virginia developed a policy whereby in the healthcare community, to ensure that healthcare facilities would remain financially viable, the state started a process where in order to open a new medical care facility, and we're not talking doctor's office, we're talking hospitals, mm-hmm. nursing homes, x-ray clinics, things of that nature, that because certain components of medical care are more profitable than others, that we wouldn't allow companies to come in, and the term used is cherry pick out those more profitable parts that would then make a hospital that's trying to provide comprehensive services to the community be unprofitable because the more profitable parts of medical care have been stripped out. That's the basic premise. It has served the Commonwealth, I think, fairly well for the time it's been in effect. It is time to look at it because it hasn't been reformed in over 10 years. And of course, we know that the healthcare community has changed tremendously, both from a free market perspective, yeah. from an insurance reimbursement, so that kind of thing. So it's one of those issues. It's important public policy-wise. It's not one of those glamorous issues where the public and the voters will get, you know, it's not a gut issue, yeah. but it is something that will directly affect medical care cost and availability. And the underlying premise is we want to do everything we can as a state government to keep cost as low as possible and accessibility and availability as high as possible throughout the Commonwealth. And that's part of the complexity. Because when you think about for our area, which is pretty urbanized, we have different medical needs and yeah. challenges compared to if you go to more rural areas like down Northern Neck, Middle Peninsula, or even down Southwest Virginia. So we've got to look at it from the total state perspective.
Is the previous regulations, is that what governed, say, Spotsylvania Regional Medical Center and Stafford Hospital coming in?
Correct. Before they could come in. They had to apply for the state for a certificate yeah. of public need and prove to the state that the population of the area was sufficient to support them and the existing medical care facilities, Mary Washington Hospital. Similarly, when a freestanding surgery center or x-ray clinic mm-hmm. goes in, they have to apply to the state and show that their coming in isn't going to draw enough service off from Mary Washington or now Spotsy Regional or Stafford. That would put them in a non-financially viable position. So that's what it's based on. There are some encumbrances. There are also costs. Anytime you have administrative overview, that adds to the cost. And so that's part of the balancing act of how much regulation, which brings cost to the system, versus letting free market work that may bring cost because it puts certain businesses in a financially unviable position.
Okay, and that'll be debated and
stay
come
tuned.
Up yeah, this coming session. Caroline Delegate, Bobby Warrock here this morning. He's in with the 54th District. The 54th District is Caroline and Spotsylvania?
About half geographically of Spotsylvania County and the northern, northeastern tip corner of Caroline.
Okay. More coming up this morning on Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFVA.
You're listening to Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFVA. Got an opinion about today's show? Text the studio now at 540-371-5756. Now, here's the host of Town Talk, Ted Schubel.
Caroline Delegate Bobby Warrock with us this morning as we preview the General Assembly session. I guess the big thing of this session will be Governor McAuliffe and his budget and dealing with that.
Yeah, and the governor in the budget he released has a lot more money anticipated than what we in the House see as truly being available, because what the governor has done is once again, at least he's being consistent for the He's anticipating that we're going to accept Medicaid expansion in Virginia that will bring, for the short term, additional federal funding. And he is anticipating, well, if we get that extra money, it frees up other monies in the budget. And so he's already spent them. When you boil it all down, long and the short, looking at the revenue growth with the existing programs we've got in the Commonwealth, we've got about $1 billion more in revenues in. Billion's a lot of money. Mm-hmm. When you re-benchmark K through 12 education for the public schools, and when we say benchmark, that's based on this formula that nobody likes of the counties, but nobody's found a better one where you don't end up with more counties that lose money than would win.
Yeah.
But when you re-benchmark that for student population growth and inflation, and we cover the additional cost of Medicaid under the current program, that's about $1 billion.
So there you go.
So there it is. And so he's proposed all these new things and the teacher raise, which if the money's there, teacher raises are a great thing. You know, public service employee raises are a great thing. Expansions for the state park system, all of these things. But we don't see the money being there, absent tying Virginia's budget even more so to the federal government. And I don't know of anybody that thinks that the federal government is doing a particularly good job of running their budget right now, and that you can really bank on those revenues from the federal government long term, because something's got to give up there. You can't keep spending money that the taxpayers don't have to give you.
So this could be another shaping up to be another contentious session, because if he's going to make Medicaid expansion again something he pushes, the votes at this point aren't there. Not in the House.
And not in the Senate. Given that the Senate is
Republican-controlled. Yeah.
That generally speaking, you're not going to see any major policies from either side. Because when you've got a Democrat governor and a Republican-controlled House and Senate, the House and Senate may put forward initiatives that then the governor doesn't agree with and may veto. And there are not votes sufficient typically in the Senate to override that veto. While we might in the House, you have to override it in both sides. So we don't get major policy changes unless the governor embraces it. Mm-hmm. Conversely, he doesn't get major policy changes unless both the House and Senate Republican majority will embrace it. And so typically, and we've kind of seen that over the past 2 years, we've made some modest changes in government, kind of tinkered around the edges, but we haven't seen any major initiative changes like we've seen in past sessions.
I know there was talk, and Republicans made mention of it during the campaign, that there was the concern that if the Senate did go to Democrat like it was 2 years ago, that there might be a government shutdown and all of that over Medicaid expansion. You wonder how far this could all go again with the governor trying to push that.
The only way, though, that I can foresee that happening
is if a Republican peels off.
Well, or even more so, if the governor just stands fast and won't sign the budget.
Okay.
And then it's going to be an us versus him, and he's out there by himself, as it were, on that issue, except with his minority members in the House and Senate. Unlike in past years where the impasse was between the House and the Senate and no budget was being produced to send to the governor. During my tenure in the Assembly, I can't think of a time when the governor has been the sole roadblock to us getting a budget passed. He's always had one House or the other to support him on the measure.
Okay. I know when as the governor rolled out the budget and talked about teacher raises in his budget, there was I know locally there was excitement about that, but as you put that forward, it sounds like a lot of that is tied to some money that may not be there.
Yeah, folks better not start spending the money they see in the governor's proposed budget, because the governor proposes and the Assembly disposes, because that's the working document that the House and Senate money committees will begin work on in January. And you won't see the final product of that until the second week of March, when we come down to the end. Conference committee will address the differences between the House and Senate versions. Historically, you don't see major changes from the base budget of the previous session, just because Virginia has always been a very financially prudent and pragmatic state in their budget planning. We have to have a balanced budget. So that's what drives it at the end of the day. If the revenues aren't there, we can't spend it. And that's how it ought to be.
It's Caroline Doug and Bobby Orrock here this morning. We're previewing the General Assembly session. Again, the budget, the big thing that that you'll be dealing with. And you mentioned just taking a look at Washington. I guess you always have to have an eye on Washington. And with the budget situation the way it is there, and with the economy the way it is, and with interest rates being raised.
And with Virginia's economy so dependent on the federal employment sector. Northern Virginia, the Tidewater area with the military presence, the sequestration that has been affected has already impacted on Virginia's revenues compared to where we were. In past years, that had been more of an insulator from some of the economic vagaries of the general economy. But now with the federal cutbacks, we're seeing less growth and even some negative numbers compared to states that haven't been as highly dependent or highly influenced, I guess is the better term, by federal spending in the state. So we'll just see how that plays out.
Right. That's something that you obviously do have to keep your eye on. And and like you say, Virginia has always been very conservative and fiscally prudent in those kind of things. But it gets tougher and tougher for what you do, and then for local governments too. I'm sure you've got local governments who are coming to you and saying, you know, hey, help us out.
Right.
And you're tied in a lot of ways.
And every level of government is dependent on the taxpayers in order to fund the government services. There are always folks who want more government services than we're ever going to be able to financially afford, because it all has a price tag. There's no such thing as federal money or state money or county money. It's all the taxpayers' money. And sometimes I think some legislators lose sight of the fact and say, oh, well, we'll get the federal dollars. And then at the county level, they say, oh, we'll get the state monies. It's all coming from the same set of taxpayers. That's what government's supposed to run on.
It was a few years ago that you signed the big transportation bill, and that was going to take care of everything. Anything new with transportation this session?
Not especially. One of the realities, given a supply and demand economy, it's odd. When more monies were made available for transportation needs, the estimates for construction went up. Because nothing against the industry on that per se, but anytime that you see that, well, there's more money available, I can now recognize that in my bidding process, that the little bank of money to pull from has gotten bigger. So we've seen the construction cost on projects go up somewhat. They're still very competitive in the industry, but overall we've seen a little bump in what project costs are going to be. The biggest change potentially is what's being called from last year's session, the House Bill 2, where that the Department of Transportation and local governments now are looking at this through a different lens of trying to prioritize money to get the biggest bang for the buck, which is a good thing policy-wise. Politically, not necessarily as good a thing, because what that does is it may mean that monies that had previously gone to this one transportation district, now because there's a greater priority in another district, they're not going to get those monies for a while, because we need them over here in order to get this more important project done in a more timely manner. It's good policy, but it kind of means certain folks don't get the transportation money in an election cycle that those elected officials might want to see coming home.
Well, and you're kind of a good example of that, of where you're dealing with part of Spotsylvania, and Spotsylvania has all kinds of transportation needs. Caroline does too, but someone, if you're looking at it, would say Spotsylvania probably should see that money first, and there may be a time that Caroline wouldn't.
And not that Caroline won't, but I'll give two specific examples. That right at the Thornburg Interchange there in Spotsylvania, major project underway, and it's going to be continuing for another 3 to 6 years as that bridge will be rebuilt, as other improvements between the interstate and Route 1. But now Caroline is looking at the next exit south at Ladysmith. They're wanting improvements because they've got a Walmart coming in. Now, Walmart has proffered certain road improvements, but not enough to handle all the traffic changes that are going to happen there. So now Caroline's going to come in and be wanting additional monies, and the Spotsy project is already out there, underway. So is that going to impact on how quickly and how much Caroline can get monies? I think it will, but I can't say for sure to the specifics of that because that's part of that formula that Transportation Board and local governments have to resolve.
Yeah. Caroline County is an interesting – you mentioned the Walmart and other things. Caroline for so long has been – and you've grown up there and seen it just kind of – it's
my
been
whole
kind
life.
Of this
yep.
– sleepy little county, but a number of things are starting to take place, and you can see where a lot of the growth and a lot of the things that have formerly been in the Fredericksburg area are going more south now.
Well, as an example, I think the new Spotsylvania commuter rail station that brings commuter rail closer to Northern Caroline County, I think we're going to see more pressures for residential growth in Northern Caroline now because transportation has always been the single biggest limiting factor for folks who live in Northern, or excuse me, who work in Northern Virginia or D.C., that commute. And so now that transportation has gotten a little closer, as it were, with the VRE station, I think Northern Caroline is going to see more residential pressures, and that's going to bring more demand for the commercial services, schools, all the things that come with more residential growth.
Caroline Delegate Bobby Orrick here this morning. We'll continue to talk and preview this General Assembly session when we come back on Town Talk and News Talk 1230 WFVA. It's now 8:30.
Okay, listen, we got to talk about something.
Talk done right. News Talk 1230 WFVA Fredericksburg, a Centennial Broadcasting Station. Welcome back to Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFVA. You can weigh in on today's Town Talk topic on Facebook at WFVA 1230. Now, here's the host of Town Talk, Ted Schubel.
Caroline Delegate Bobby Orrick with us this morning as we preview the session of the General Assembly. You used to always drive a red pickup truck. Are you still driving that? Are you still doing that?
No, I'm not. That one of the reasons, and maybe this brought us full circle, you talked about my license plate number back at the beginning. You can't put that on a vehicle over a half ton. And I've gotten up to a one-ton pickup now for various towing needs that I have around the house. And I couldn't put my delegate plate on that, so I've actually got it on my 2001 Grand Marquis at over 200,000 miles and still loving it and just rocking on. So anyway.
For years and years, I would see you around town, and you always had that
pickup truck.
Red pickup truck. Being an educator, I know when Senator Houck was in the Senate, he was one of the few educators in the state Senate. Are there many educators in the House of Delegates?
Several retired educators.
Okay,
I'm the only. I believe the only with the new elections. I'm not positive. I think I'm the only active public school educator. There's one or two others that teach in a private school setting. It's interesting, when I was first elected, Education Committee was one that I had asked to be placed on, and of course I was not and still not. And so go figure. You know,
never have been on the Education Committee.
Education Committee.
That's surprising.
But of course, you've got 140 education experts.
Yeah.
Because everybody in the legislature had an education, so of course they know how it's supposed to be. And I said that a little bit tongue-in-cheek, nothing against any of my peers, but that's life. We tend to base our judgments on our experiences, and everybody had an education. So it worked for us, so why shouldn't it work for today's kids, even though they're a little bit different?
Well, and with being in a more rural setting and someone who's an ag teacher, you've been able to do things with also, with not only education, but agriculture and those kind of issues.
Right, and I am the longest-serving member on the House Ag Committee, so I've always tried to look out for the agricultural interest, which those two have changed over the years. You know, you've got your traditional family farms, your larger corporate farms, and now we're seeing even more smaller niche market, shall we call them, type farms that into specialty crops or organics. And we've got to make sure that there's going to be an economic climate viable for all of the agriculture components.
Well, that's a good point. That those were issues we never did see before.
Yeah.
But the family farm is shrinking, and like you say, and farmers markets have we see it around here and just across the state of every locality now has multiple farmers markets.
And the balance of late, or the pressures of late, have been between how much government regulation do we need to have in place to ensure a safe food supply for the public versus public accessibility to food products that they may have a desire to have, and how much does the government do to protect people from themselves when they don't necessarily know all the health risk factors of unprocessed foods, things of that nature. So that's the current kind of back and forth, trying to find that perfect balance between the two.
The with so much gun laws have become such a big issue nationally. Do you see anything on the horizon? Anything to be talked about in the legislature?
I'm sure we'll see legislation introduced that would impact on the current gun laws that are on the books. I doubt we'll see any of them particularly coming out of the Militia and Police Committee, because at the end of the day, if the current gun laws are enforced, Virginia's got some of the toughest of any state around. The problem comes, criminals don't obey the laws, mm-hmm. period. So then how far can we go? You know, just putting more laws on the books that criminals are going to ignore doesn't solve the problem. It just infringes then on the rights of legal gun owners in being able to have guns that they want for hobby purposes, things of that nature. So there again is the, how do we strike that proper balance?
Well, and I know, boy, you get into gun laws and it becomes, it draws in people, and you get very sharp reactions to things. I remember a few years ago, the whole, we talked about it before that session, the whole Sunday hunting bill was a huge, once it hit the General Assembly, brought everybody from all corners of the state out.
Tremendous controversy on that measure, and you know, I had sympathy on both sides of the matter. I've got to say, and I was just sharing with someone this past week, as it's been implemented in Virginia so far, I have received zero complaints about the current Sunday hunting practices. In my part of the world there in Northern Caroline County, I couldn't tell you that there is Sunday hunting, because I'm not seeing people out on the roads as some had feared, things of that nature. So far, so good. I'm glad, you know, that's how it's working out, and that the non-hunters aren't complaining, and the hunters now, those few that want to go hunting on Sunday, can practice their hobby in that regard.
In the, especially in the Spotsylvania sheriff's race this past year, body cameras became a huge issue, and it became I know in some other races in the state, a lot of it came back to funding, that locally didn't have the funding. Do you see that the General Assembly will be asked to step into that?
Oh, I'm sure we're going to be asked, but as you said, it relates to, are the money there? And at the root of it all, everybody's got a smartphone, and I even had to break down and get one this past year, even though I still think it's smarter than I am. But
I did too, so we have we're together here on this.
And so everybody is being videotaped almost everywhere you go when anything happens. So part of the justification for having the body cameras is so that there is then their side of the video. I was watching a PBS special this past week that was talking about meteors and asteroids, and they were showing some of the footage of the latest that hit in Russia 2 or 3 years ago now. And they were saying that they've never had one that was as documented as they saw in Russia, because in Russia, apparently, everybody's got a video camera in their car.
Huh.
As we're starting to see that develop here in the United States, Russia's been having them for years. And so they've got all this dash cam footage from private vehicles in Russia that showed this meteor streaking across the sky and where it impacted, and seeing it from different angles. And so the meteorologists are just going nuts. They're thinking this is awesome, because they've never been able to study one as much as they have been with this one, with actual footage. So I think that's just, we're seeing it in society, and everything. You better not plan to do anything anymore that won't have a video record of whatever you're doing.
Right. Well, and the General Assembly has run into that, because I remember a few years ago, and I think it was a class at VCU, they were doing video from up above.
Oh, yeah.
And you know, found legislators surfing the internet. I mean, it became a thing, I know, where you had to be careful,
right,
of just people sitting in the balcony of the General Assembly, kind of watching what everyone was doing.
And not that that's bad at all, except it has to be taken in context.
Right.
Because, for instance, sometimes we may be at ease, where we're still in session, mm-hmm. but no business is going to be going on. And so if a member, when you're at ease, takes out his crossword puzzle, because he's just sitting there with a half hour to kill between.
Yeah.
Is that such a bad thing? But if that's what they videotape,
and then tell you that this is during the session.
During session, because technically it is. But it's not like any business was going on or any discussion or anything of that nature. No policy was being considered.
Yeah. No, that is a very good point, that there are a lot of stops and starts in the General Assembly, and you do have to put it in context. But again, it's cameras around everywhere. And I guess that's one of the big changes of the years you've been down there. There weren't at that time when you first started the floor sessions were not something that we could watch in on.
That they were being videotaped, but they were just being archived.
Yeah,
and for the press or public to access them, they had to submit a FOIA request. In recent years, we do now. It's live streaming. You can watch both the House and Senate sessions live through all of our stops and starts and lull times and things of that nature, which is a good thing because transparency, of course, has always been important. But folks need to remember that even when we weren't videotaping anything, all of our sessions, subcommittees, full committees, floor sessions, are open to the public and have always been there for the public scrutiny because we work to serve them. That's what the job is all about. They're our bosses.
Caroline Delegate, Bobby Orrick here this morning on Town Talk. It's always interesting to hear. You especially a lot of times have some interesting bills that you introduce just because they're kind of the common man bills in some way of things that you get from people in your district that ask you to do anything. Are you looking at anything at this session?
Well, in that respect, it's been kind of a quiet year. But, Ted, you are exactly right. It's not like that. For any time that I've been in the assembly that I sit around thinking, well, what do we need to do to change the law in this particular area? But rather it's driven by constituent contacts to me where they've run into a situation where there's been a problem with the existing law and do we need to tweak it? Sometimes by introducing a bill to make a change to the law, it kind of gets the attention of the bureaucrats and they may interpret the current law a little differently and affect resolution for the constituent who contacted me. Sometimes we do need to make some changes. One bill we put in last year, the intent was to make some minor changes in the language as it relates to private animal shelters and encourage more adoption. Actually, by the little change we made, which all we did was just take words of the existing law and moved them into a different place, but words matter. And the effect has been that technically now a private animal shelter that's taking animals that are unadoptable because of age or health issues, a rescue facility, as it were, they're not going to be able to get 501c3 status because they can't call themselves a shelter because by changing the law, we said if you aren't doing any adoptions, then you can't call yourself a shelter. But I think all of us would agree that there are animals we just want to be able to have a place for them to live out their lives comfortably, and shouldn't folks be able to get donations towards that end to assist them in taking care of it? So that's a bill I'm going to be introducing to try and fix that and just get it back to a status quo, putting emphasis on we want adoptions, but it's not always the best answer because the alternative is then you got to put them down.
Right.
So
yeah, it's interesting. Just a word change. Word change here and there, and I guess in like you say, some years it depends on if you hear from people and you get something through. The House in recent years has put a cap, haven't they, on how many bills you're supposed to put forward.
The House has imposed bill limits. Once session has convened, we can only put in 5 bills after the pre-filed deadline. That's for either the short or long session. We've taken a further step than in the short session because it's 15 days less and because it's technically there just to address changes we need to make in the budget. We have imposed a hard 15-bill limit on each member of the House. This being the long session, members can put in as many bills as they want pre-filed.
Okay.
But once the pre-filed deadline has cut off and the ability to ask for such bills was actually 2 weeks ago, so anything now that I might consider putting in goes towards that one of my 5 that I have to go forward.
Okay. Caroline Delegate, Bobby Orrick here. We'll wrap this up when we come back this morning on Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFVA.
You're listening to Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFVA. Got an opinion about today's show? Text the studio now at 540-371-5756. Now, here's the host of Town Talk, Ted Schubel.
We're previewing the upcoming General Assembly session with Caroline Delegate Bobby Orrick. It was about the 13th or something of January. It's the second Wednesday.
Second Wednesday in January. Constitution says we go into session. So.
And so that night, usually the governor gives his State of the Commonwealth, and then
on the 13th, we'll be back there for a joint session in the House with the House and Senate and hear the governor and go from there.
Off you go. The one of the issues, you being an educator, it's always interesting talking education with you. It seems that with a lot of things out there with homeschooling in Virginia, just the numbers continue to grow. And even you look at a lot of the testing numbers that mm-hmm. that homeschoolers get continue to be very high, and with money the way it is the whole public education model is think over time that's got to change.
And this is my 38th year of teaching, so you know I've devoted my life to public education, but that whole education model, as you said, is changing. We're going to see bills, I know, this coming session pushing for more virtual classroom type settings. That's something that I think the more urban parts of our state will be able to take advantage of. Now, one of the problems and challenges it brings, most of the area in which I teach in western Spotsylvania, they don't have high-speed internet access necessarily. And without that, you don't have a virtual school environment in your home. So we're trying to work through those challenges. The whole model, as you suggested, as it relates to homeschooling, we passed legislation last year that allows homeschool students to apply and take two classes at the public school. We're seeing some of that happen. That's potentially to everyone's best interest, but as a part of that is probably going to have to come additional funding to those local school divisions because they've now got them as students at least part-time and how that's going to get resolved. The infamous Tebow bill.
Yeah, that's been an interesting to see how that's been debated.
And what that's been, and 38 states allow some type of participation by non-public school students in public school sports, and that's the root of it. And what this would have allowed is a mandate, basically. The patron has said it's never been a mandate, but when you have a legislation that says no school division can be a member of a sports group that doesn't allow this type of thing. Well, it's okay. It's a mandate.
Saying
the Virginia High School League either has to change their rules or this county can't be a part of the Virginia High School League. And if you're not a part of the high school league, then you can't compete against other schools that are.
Yeah.
And you can't go for championships and you can't do all these other things. So it was a mandate. You know, personally, I have opposed it because I hate mandates. You know, I think if we're going to do this, we need to be honest and upfront and say, here's the deal. All right.
You're going to do this.
You got to do this. I think this coming session, there have been some discussions about that we may see a Tebow-type bill with a delayed effective date of 1 year to basically put a mandate out there, soft, if you were, where that high school league, you either change your rules or this one's coming down the pike. And if there's some compelling reason why it shouldn't be forced upon you this coming year, then make your case, work among the legislators, and we can come back next session and repeal it before it goes into effect. I think the King's Dominion bill, as it's been called frequently, with required delayed until after Labor Day opening, I think it's just a matter of time before that will finally get repealed. I've always supported local school divisions need to be able to pick their own start and stop times because it's not the same all the way across the Commonwealth. Yeah. Why should folks in more western counties be hamstrung by the same requirements of folks who are closer to the Busch Gardens, the King's Dominions, the type of entertainment facilities like that, that pushed for the original legislation. I think it's time for a change on that venue as well.
You know, it would be interesting. I know then on the federal level, the No Child Left Behind Act has been changed.
And as a result of that, we're going to be seeing more changes, I think, in Virginia standards of learning testing. I put in a bill last year that tries to affect right now graduation statistics are something that is counted against the school system for their accreditation, which I agree with the concept. But unfortunately, in the current practice, even when those students don't graduate through no fault of the school system, specifically if a student might be arrested and put in a juvenile detention facility. It still goes against the school division that they didn't graduate on time, even though the school division had nothing to do with the fact that that student made a bad choice, did a criminal act, and his way. And there are other instances where students move into the area from out of state. They were already behind in their schooling when they arrived in Virginia. My principal was telling me this past year that we got a student as a sophomore who had been in 12 different school systems by the time he got to us as a sophomore.
Wow.
So there were a number of times, you know, he was never in a school system more than a single year, and there were a number of years when he was in two different school systems. So he was way behind in his learning progress, and yet we were still going to be expected to have him graduate in 3 years.
Yeah. Before we get out of here, just about out of time, if someone wants to get in touch with you, either locally or in the General Assembly, I know you always like to get comments.
I've got a website, Delegate Bobby Orok. Folks can contact us during session. Just go to the virginia.gov website and click on the legislature and pull up contact information. I've got a local office. That local number is 891-1322. So there are any number of ways. I'm on Facebook. So, yeah, folks, I'm out there. Just find me and love to hear from you.
891-1322, you said?
Is that local number.
Is the local number for...
Which we shut that down during session, but we have the information on there of the direct number to Richmond.
And you can just hop online and see all that. Bobby Orok from the 54th District that includes Caroline and Spotsylvania County. Well, good luck in the General Assembly session. It's a longer session this year, and thanks for talking issues with us this morning. And Merry Christmas.
Thank you. Merry Christmas. Happy New Year to you as well, Dan.
That's it for Town Talk. Thanks for listening. See you tomorrow on News Talk 1230 WFVA.
Thanks for listening to Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFVA. The views expressed by the host and guests on this program are their own and not necessarily those of this station, its management, or Centennial Broadcasting. The Glenn Beck Program is next on News Talk 1230 WFVA.